Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Hello, listener. This is Rhys James, the host of Early Work. Wait, this is the podcast you're listening to right now. I don't know. Why would you click on it then if you don't? Anyway, I'm here to tell you that the tour that I had been on for a while has resumed. It resumes in February. Tickets are back on sale for that tour. It had to be postponed. We were about three quarters of the way through the tour, and then it had to be postponed because, let me be the first to tell you, there's a pandemic going around at the moment. But we've now resumed it. We're going to do some shows in the spring, in February and March, that are going to be reduced capacity shows that are socially distanced, just in case. And those are in Sheffield, Cambridge, Canterbury, Oxford, Bristol, and Nottingham. There will be a couple of shows a night. Tickets are sort of available. And then, where the tickets are really available is in the summer. May and June, we're doing some shows that are planning to go ahead as normal. Fingers crossed that this vaccine works. And they are in Leeds, Liverpool, Salford, Swindon, London, and Norwich. So, go and get your tickets. There is a chance that I will be deleting this intro to a podcast and claiming that those summer shows were also meant to be socially distanced. I don't want to have to do that. So go and get your tickets. Here's the podcast. Get your tickets. Here's the podcast now, though. But get your tickets. Get your tickets. Welcome to another Early Work, the podcast in which I ask guests to bring the creative writing of their youth for me, the nation's little brother, to judge. Before I put my tail between my legs and stand down from the bench to read something from my own embarrassing and tragic childhood. This week's guest is the phenomenal Katie Wicks. You've probably seen Katie in Not Going Out, or Anna and Katie, her sketch show from a few years ago, or Ghosts, or probably the best British sitcom of the last decade, Staff Let's Flats. Phenomenal show. If you've not seen that, it's so funny. You've got to find it. It's on All Four and probably Hulu. In this episode, she gives us one of the weirdest Red Nose Day experiences with a teacher ever. She tells me I look like every Welsh boy she went to school with, and she reads a variety of poems, from the light with sort of Spike Milligan-style jauntiness to roast battle-type one-liners to the dark and twisted Philip Larkin-level shit, all the way to the naively romantic with one of the most teenage lines of poetry in L'Histoire. Plus, I get one of my predictions of what she was like at school so insanely bang on, it's almost biblical, and she absolutely doesn't give a shit. So here it is, the early work of Katie Wicks. Joining me on this week's early work is Katie Wicks. Hello, Katie Wicks.
Hey, hello.
For those of you who don't know, Katie Wicks is probably best known for the fact that me and her have identical headache schedules, as proven this week, when we sort of both pulled out of this podcast recording at the same time due to both having migraines.
Do you know what? It's still there. What happened? And I've never had a 3-day migraine before. It was so stupid. What happened was because, so during lockdown, like everyone else, I got really into yoga and Pilates and your friend of mine, Yoga Lattes. And then I saw a friend recently who I hadn't seen for about 3 months. And the first thing she said to me, she said, oh, like, your posture's really good. Like, what have you done? Because partly because I've spent the last 2 years writing a book, which we'll get onto, I'm sure, at some point. But and because I didn't write the book in any correct position that you're meant to write in, because it just never seemed to suit the sort of emotional temperature of what I was doing. I needed to be kind of like in a ball shape to write it. Anyway, so because I fucked my back and shoulders writing, I was just all kind of like, you know, like a sort of question mark shape. So I've suddenly realized during lockdown, like if I sort of stretch myself out, that I look better. So that night I decided, which is so kind of my ridiculous kind of addict brain, I thought, well, I don't want to just have good posture. I want to have like the best posture of anyone I've ever met. So I went online and started doing kind of improve your posture exercises. And I stretched my neck. I did something to my neck that was too extreme, triggered a migraine, and it lasted for about 2 days. So yeah. I just feel like it's completely self-induced from trying to. So the terrifying conclusion, walking around with the correct posture has caused me so much pain.
It's a dangerous game. Well, I mean, you did go for the greatest posture in England. So if you'd just gone for sort of normal, solid posture, you probably, you know, maybe have a headache for 10 minutes. But you tried to, you basically flew too close to the sun. And now,
it was like I couldn't just accept someone saying, oh, your posture looks good. I decided,
you wanted
right,
a trophy.
That's, it's like a wager you put down.
Good, you say. You need to say that's the best posture I've ever seen in my life. Well, my migraine was also self-induced, but that's just because I got ludicrously drunk for no reason on Tuesday on Zoom alone in my house.
I still think that's the more usual way of getting a migraine than my way.
It certainly like wasn't competitive posture based. It's not something I've heard of before. fair enough. Well, if I had to guess what you were like at school, Katie, and I do because it's the first part of the show, here's what I've written. One word at first, skits. Now, I know that seems pretty basic because you've been a successful sketch performer professionally, but you do strike me as someone who did skits as a child. I reckon you had wigs in the house. I reckon you could do voices and accents, maybe impressions of family members or like local figures. I've got in my head the idea that maybe there was like a milkman or a vicar or something that everyone knew was a bit ripe for mocking, like in an impression or something, but adults thought it was too rude to do it themselves. But a kid doing it is innocent and therefore a perfect outlet. And I think that outlet that was lived vicariously through you. At school, I'd say that meant you were a bit in a world of your own. I reckon you had a small, close friendship group who appreciated your talent and comedy characters, but you'd switch it off completely when people from outside groups were too close, which meant you never really harnessed it in assembly or in front of the whole year group in a performance, unless it was a school play where you hadn't written it. And then my guess is that you were probably head and shoulders above everyone acting wise, but never made a fuss, so didn't get the main parts due to politics. Probably quite academic at specific subjects. And I can imagine you randomly just getting the best score in a subject no one's really passionate about, like RE or French. Is any of that correct?
I got the best score in RE and maybe the county.
Oh, no way. Best posture, best RE in the county.
Which is weird because I came from a very atheist household. It was really weird how good I was at RE.
Are you winding me up?
No.
Are you serious? That's true. Yeah. You actually got the best score in RE.
Yeah, it's really weird. It's a bit like having a correct tarot read or something.
Why are you not more amazed by the fact that I predicted that you got the best RE? You were amazing at RE.
I think because I'm too freaked out and I'm containing how freaked out I am.
I mean, a lot of the time when I read these, I get them pretty accurate. I get them pretty bang on. I've never said something as specific as that, and it's been that. I picked RE at random.
It was when you started to say, because I was, to be honest, a lot of it I was thinking no, but I could see how you'd think that, and I'll come on to that. But then when you got to that bit, and you said, what did you say? Something no one else is passionate about.
Yeah, I said academic at a specific subject and randomly getting the best score in a subject no one cares about.
When you began that bit, I thought, oh, this feels too weird. And then when you said RE, I thought, no, this is.
I mean, I keep thinking you're just doing some improv on me, but to sort of level that, the rest of it's bollocks.
Well, no, it wasn't bollocks. It was like, well, it's a tricky one because I was different, depending on what age you're talking about, is I was very different in school. I didn't really blossom until sixth form, I'd say. So there were definitely skits, like my parents were funny and could do impressions and were really kind of performative and big.
Who would they do impressions of?
Oh, like, who are they doing impressions of? You know, like, my dad was always doing his Sean Connery. He kind of looked a bit like Sean Connery. He was a model in his youth.
Wow.
I know. And, yeah, they were really glamorous, my parents. And who were they doing impressions of? Like, local people, like you say, but also... So there were wigs in the house. There were skits. But I was painfully shy and extremely sort of sensitive. So outside of the house, I would tend not to speak a lot. It was kind of like selective mutism. Like, there were some lessons I just decided not to speak in. And once I'd made the decision, for some reason, it just meant I couldn't speak. It was really kind of like black and white. So I was really quiet in school and just a bit overwhelmed. And I just thought it was so shit that you had to go every day. Like, I went to the local comp down the road. It was just a lot of kind of... All I remember is, like, just disgusting coloured tights and walking up concrete steps, like, a lot. And I would just think, I can't believe I have to come here every day. It's kind of in a sort of small businessman's outfit and just walk around. But despite that, I was the first person from my family to go to university. Small friendship group, that's true. But then, yeah, I think I was just very quiet. And then at one point I was bullied. So then I was like really, you know, I was quite pathetic after that. It took me about a year to recover. But by the time I got to, by the time I was like 16, 17, that's when I met my proper best friends for life and still are. And then that was like an incredible time. And then I suddenly...
Was it the same? Were you at the same school?
Yeah. And it was only then that I thought I was funny. But I do remember when I was about 7, according to my parents, apparently I did an impression of Dennis Norden one Christmas time that was really infamous, which is such a weird thing for a small girl to do an impression of. I sort of picked up a clipboard and did an impression of Dennis Norden. But I do remember doing a sketch, a blind date sketch in school. That was in front of the whole school. We had this thing in Wales, you would probably know being semi-Welsh, called the Eisteddfods.
I'm going to level with you. I mean, I barely know anything about Wales. Before this podcast recorded, you were like, you're Welsh, aren't you? And then I sort of said, yes, I thought it would help. I mean, I'm half Welsh.
You look like every boy that went to my school, basically.
Really? I mean, but is that just because I still look like a boy at school?
Or maybe it's that too.
Yeah. I just look like a young boy. Really? Is there a particular Welsh look?
Yeah, well, I'd say like dark hair, dark features.
Right, okay. Yeah.
Well, we had these things called, Eisteddfod, which was like a sort of mini arts festival that you'd have every year in school and everyone had to take part. And
compulsory. Everyone had to do like a performance.
I think so. Or everyone had to do... Because obviously being a school in Wales, it always felt like, you know, if you were good at rugby, that was like really sort of praised and nothing else really mattered. That's the overriding feeling I remember. But what was quite good about Eisteddfod was that it was things like song and poetry and clog dancing. And it was like quite kind of artsy. And you sort of, everyone had to join in, like every class had to do something, which was quite good. So there was a lot of like... We had these competitions where you'd have to like pretend you're in a, but you'd have to pick a song, pick a band, and then just dress up as that band and mime along on stage in front of the whole school. And one, this is really sad actually, we did The Clash and I was the drummer, and the night before we were due to do this performance, my mum said to me, I said I felt a bit sick, which was probably nerves. I was probably about 12 or something. And she said something like, oh, you look really pale, actually. Maybe you shouldn't go in tomorrow. And I just went, yeah, that sounds great. So I just didn't go in. And this other girl had to step in. And for some reason, it really haunts me because I had no sense of like, oh, that's going to really fuck everyone over for the performance tomorrow. It was like, do I stay home and, you know, eat chocolate with my mum, or do I go to school? I'll just stay home.
I was like that. I would just get too nervous and then just immediately have an excuse to not do something. But it's like they say, isn't it? It's the Clash lip syncs you don't do that you regret the most on your deathbed. Yeah.
Should I stay or should I go now?
Yeah.
Literally.
when you would do that, though, the lip sync thing, so did you ever actually do it? Or was that the one year that you could have done it and then you sort of got too nervous?
No, I think the next year it was like I did something else. Oh, no, the next year we did a blind date sketch. And I did do an impression of Cilla Black that was quite famous in front of the whole school. And that was a real moment of going, oh my God, this is like, I can do this. This is a piece of piss.
Did it give you status?
Yeah, it got me attention for the first. It's like I was noticed. I think because I'd been especially quiet, it was like no one was expecting me to then not just sort of do something, but do it in front of everyone. It's like that weird thing that performers have, isn't it? Where it's less scary to perform intimacy in front of 1,000 people than to actually one-on-one sometimes say something to someone. Like the way that confessional stand-up feels somehow less terrifying than telling the one person. Yeah. You know that whole thing, like so many stand-ups write, you know, they write about a breakup and perform it to everyone. But actually, when you talk to the person that they were in a relationship with, they're like, well, it wasn't like that. They're not this like
yeah,
amazing
they're really closed
sensitive.
Off and they won't reveal anything. That,
yeah,
they're
yeah,
just writing in their
yeah,
little notepad the, and they're
exactly.
going off to their basements.
Yeah, where it's actually like when you they were really bad at like genuine one-on-one intimacy, but they can make a whole audience feel like, you know, they've just written it for you and it's really intimate.
Well, that's the thing, isn't it? Yeah, comedians are famously bad communicators, even though the job is communication. They just...
Well, yeah, yeah. Exactly.
It's all thinking, isn't it? It's all just thinking and then... It's easy to retell it as a joke.
Yeah, completely. And because you're in control of it. It's totally one-sided conversation. It's not a real risky conversation in real life. But I also remember this is really, really bad because my... So when my parents, like, they gave up their kind of dreams of acting when they've had kids, basically. So there was a weird thing going on where they were kind of slightly living vicariously through everything I did in a good way, but also in a slightly kind of weird way because... It's almost like you want to rebel and do something new and interesting. And to me, it was a weird thing of feeling like I've just, it was like the family trade almost. But so both my parents went and worked like backstage in the theatre when they gave up acting. But what it meant was that I would spend a lot of time like hanging around backstage theatres and like watching, you know, performers rehearse and this kind of thing. And I remember when school play started, I had this, it sounds so snobby, but I remember looking at it and thinking, nah, I'll wait. I'll wait till I'm doing it properly.
Yes,
like, I'm
yes,
all right.
Please. I'll save myself a Broadway.
Yeah, it was literally like I would watch like 15-year-olds do stuff and I'd think, nah, it's a bit...
Not getting
it's not
that.
Great, is it? Like, I don't think I want to bother with that.
Yeah, I think that makes perfect sense. Of course, if you've never seen or done anything, you're quite happy at school to go, oh my God. Yeah, of course we'll do this. There's like one light. This is amazing.
Yeah.
They've printed out scripts and there's a hole punch. But if you've
yeah,
actually been
completely.
In a proper theatre and seen it,
yeah,
why would
like
you ever
I've been
accept
spoiled.
That?
Yeah, and it was really weirdly arrogant and I don't know where I got the confidence from, but I just knew that I could sort of do it even though I'd never done it. It was really weird. Like I used to act stuff out in my bedroom and I'd think, oh, that's really good. Well, I just got to wait another 12 years and then I'll like show someone.
Yeah.
And I also remember something else, you can stop me if this is boring, really weird about primary school, in that on Comic Relief Day, we all had to kind of write a little note saying what we wanted to happen. Or maybe it was a few days before. You wrote on a note like, what I want on Comic Relief Day is for, you know, all the teachers to dye their hair purple or something like that. And I think I wrote something like, I think all the teachers should have lunch, pack lunch on the floor, and all the students should get to sit on the chairs or something. So it got picked. The headmaster was like, looking back, I feel like he was a bit obsessed with me, which sounds really weird. Because he, maybe he's dead now. So I remember him reading out my one and saying, this is what we're going to do. And then he said, so what's going to happen on Comic Relief Day is that you and I, Katie, are going to have like a special lunch together. And I remember thinking like, that's not what I wrote. Like what? So then this like romantic dinner for two was laid out.
Oh
on the stage
what?
In front of everyone. And me and the headmaster had like a romantic lunch for Comic Relief. Isn't that fucking weird? And I remember at
what
one point
are you talking about?
He poured me some water out of like a decanter into a wine glass, just water. And I said, I could get used to this. Isn't that fucking weird?
I mean, I've got 6 billion questions. I mean, what are you, what the, f-
First of all, I cannot believe that anecdote began with, stop me if this is boring. It's most interesting and revealing anecdotes I've ever heard in my life. First of all, what I find mad is that the teachers are so devoid of inspiration, they're literally outsourcing their skits. Secondly, I don't find it weird that your skit gets picked, but then, so you suggested this sort of role reversal.
But it wasn't even a skit. It was just like,
what can we do?
What do you want to do? So why was it on a stage?
But your thing was, the teachers eat like we eat and we eat like they eat, right?
Yeah,
and just swap it and everyone's
done
it.
We used to eat on the disgusting floor with like peas rolling around.
Sure. And so you just wanted to swap the roles and that was funny. It'd be funny to see adults sitting cross-legged having to eat lunch.
Yes, precisely.
And then that didn't happen. Yours got picked, but that didn't happen at all. And all that happened is you and the headmaster had a romantic dinner for two on stage while the rest of the school watched.
I think they ate their lunch too.
But on
but
the ground.
They ate their lunch on the ground with everyone, like, their heads turned towards us.
And so you were like, so you saying I could get used to this is like you're, is like he's a king and you're just now a young.
His wife, his concubine. It was like I'd been promoted from sitting on the ground squash to his water out of. In his big glass.
Yeah.
And the fact that he had like a tea towel on his arm and poured me the water. And I just remember going, I could get used to this. And him laughing. And looking back, it's just very weird. He had slightly too longer fingernails. And, you know, it was really like possessive. It was like he wanted to possess me.
Did you go home and tell your parents about that?
I don't remember doing that. No, I remember thinking, I feel really uncomfortable. And why am I on a raised platform having lunch with the adult, with the man with the beard? And the main thing I remember is just the total confusion of, but that's not what I suggested.
So what writing have you brought? So what era are we talking? What sort of stuff is the stuff that you're willing to share?
Well, I brought in some poems.
We're not actually in a classroom. We're actually on stage having dinner, and I'm going to pour you a lovely glass of water in a minute. And you can get used to this as much as you like.
I get used to this. Oh, God, it's so funny. One's even called Ship Home That Took Literally 2 Minutes. That's how much I want the reader to know that I'm not even trying my best.
Don't even care. I didn't even revise.
I think I was about 12.
Okay.
Or 13. So here's the thing. Like, I didn't come from a literary, you know, household. And in my school library, there was like a tiny poetry section that was like Roger McGough. Basically, I just didn't have access to good poems until I was about 17 when I got my Sylvia Plath on. But before then, I just literally thought Roger McGough was poetry. I remember Blake. I remember doing Blake for GCSE, and that was like quite a massive moment. But yeah.
So were these poems that you would have been made to write for school or something, or were they
extracurricular? It was like an emotional outlet. I was a really emotional kid, and you know, quite sort of spiritual in a funny way. Hence the RE, but I was quite kind of I was really into mysticism and anything that was slightly esoteric, and like Buddhism I was quite obsessed with when I was about 14. So I was sort of looking for answers, you know. But it wasn't like poetry was on my radar. It wasn't until I got a lot older and I was like, oh my God, I didn't have the language to express this, but that is what I was feeling. Like, I had no idea that adults express this kind of stuff. I just thought it was, you know, me in my bedroom painting the walls sort of purple and being like, oh God, I have all this longing. Like, I didn't know, you know, I just didn't have the means to sort of express it. But yeah, and I drew a lot and I was really into art and stuff. So there was always, you know, I was quite poetic, but I didn't have any, you know, it's not like we had like loads of books. My parents, they're not thick. It was just that they had like, they had plays and stuff, which I definitely remember acting out bits of, you know, Top Girls and stuff. So there was that angle. There was always sort of drama.
Well, look, I can't tell you how much I'm looking forward to reading a poem influenced by Buddhism and nothing else, and no poetry.
Should I start with a funny one?
Yeah, when you say funny one, is it one that was aiming to be funny as a 12-year-old?
I don't know. They're all deadly, deadly, deadly serious, and that's the thing. They're about death and...
Oh, lovely.
You know, but there's just one which really made me chuckle because I don't know what it means. It's called Dear Carol Vorderman. And it's just this. Dear Carol Vorderman, which is more important to you, maths or your face? Thanks for your time.
Roasted. Unlucky Carol Vorderman. Get on Roast Battle. Get on Comedy Central's Roast Battle against Carol Vorderman and say, I wrote this when I was 12 and nothing's changed.
There's songs. I wrote songs quite a lot.
Wow, just lyrics?
Just the lyrics. Oh God, it's so cringe. I can't handle it. Okay, there's one called The Octopus Has Three Hearts.
Yes, please.
The Octopus Has Three Hearts. I swam to the bottom of the ocean where the raindrops cannot reach, but the pain rests deep in her all-night ball gown. A puddle floats by, her mouth full of bliss. I push by, I sink high, the thud of a heart and my eyes dart. The octopus cries, I only have three. I need one for loving and I need one for swimming, and the last one is just mean.
Wow, okay. I mean, the poem is deep, and I, no pun intended, but I don't understand what the hell that last word means.
One heart is for loving.
Yeah,
that makes sense.
One is for
the
swimming.
The other heart is for swimming, and the other heart is just a mean heart.
Yeah, all right.
I like it. It's quite surreal. Yeah.
I like, there's some phrases in there that are very teenage poetry. All night ball gown, mouthful of bliss.
Yeah. Oh my God, there's some really, oh my God. Right, okay. This one is so cringe. And also the other thing I should point out was that because I hadn't really read any poetry, I thought poetry should rhyme.
Oh, don't worry. I mean, there's many people who've come on this podcast or who listen to this podcast who would still argue it should rhyme.
Yeah. That's not me.
Yeah.
Okay, this one starts. The house is a mess, but the kettle's on. Soon she'll get a visit from John. He's the man from 42. He likes Bob Dylan and he comes from Crewe. First blood pressure and then he will take out his box of small red pills. Red ones first as he tilts her head back. This will calm you down. Now try and relax. She can't scream. She can't run away. She needs these pills to get through the day. That wasn't so bad, John reassures her, filling in his report, trying to ignore her. John's got to go. He reaches for his hat, not looking down, just missing the cat. She won't see him now until tomorrow. That's if she can find some hours to borrow. If she can try and look after herself without real care, without any wealth.
Wow. Oh, my God.
What's it about?
What's it? What inspired that?
I've no idea.
John, 42, from Crewe. A carer, by the sounds of it. Is that being too generous to say a carer?
Yeah, it's. I have absolutely no idea, but I remember writing it.
Red
pills. I really remember.
What do you remember about the environment of you writing that?
I just remember, that I would spend time. I was quite good at being alone. I liked spending time in my room, and I liked just being surrounded by all the, you know, my objects, and. There was just always, you know, hours of happy creativity, and it would either be drawing or painting or sort of like dancing about or acting stuff out or making stuff. I was always making stuff or writing. I just remember, just hours of like really contented creativity. And now it's like I can go for hours, I think. It's funny, like I think I have a shit attention span, but if it's something I care about, I can sort of go for hours.
What,
which is good.
Did you read? Would you have read any of these three poems so far to anyone?
No. I think it was just like a purely private thing, an outlet. Okay, shall I try another one?
Yeah, I mean, what a range we've had so far. We've had Dear Carol Vorderman, we've had one about an octopus and three octopus hearts, and then we get on to John 42 from Crewe, comes and gives you red pills.
There's a funny one or a more serious one.
I'm easy. Now, come on, why don't we compare and contrast?
Let's do them both. Okay, this is quite good. This is called personification. Through the method of personification, we do find the following information. The bogeyman is not a lot, but purely personification of snot. It's quite clever.
Oh, is that the...
That's it.
Oh, great. It's, yeah, great. That's like a Spike Milligan. I mean, it's...
Yeah. This is called Message for Gareth.
Okay.
So this is obviously to a boy. Oh my God, it's so shit. I don't understand. I need more. Everyone else looks and the message they understand is different to the transmission. No one is the same, so don't feel any less just because you're not loud or because you can't make people laugh. I know what you mean about sex.
What? Oh my God.
Just saying, I know what you mean about it. It's so ridiculous. I know what you mean about sex. Things will get better. There are so many people who do what I do, but we need more of you. You laugh not because you think it's funny, but because you think you should. And it's not right that being flippant brings you friends. You're wrong. You'll see it soon. The end.
Oh my God, Gareth. I mean, first of all, of course, you went to school in Wales. This person is called, yeah, Gareth. Secondly, I mean, there's so much in that. It's so confusing where you're coming from. At first, fucking it seems hell. Like you're saying you're not giving me enough, like he's going to be a brick wall. But then he seems like this really polite guy who's like laughing because he's, you know, it's courteous. But you are really against it. And then you're like, no one is the same. It's fine to be this person. But then you're like, you'll see soon. You're wrong. You're wrong to be this person. And in the middle of all that, I know what you mean about sex.
That's the best bit.
What did he mean? What did he mean about sex?
No, I don't remember. It's such a funny opening. Like, you know what? I know. I was thinking what you said, yeah, the other day, and I know what you mean about sex. It could mean so many things. It's so intriguing. I know what you mean about sex.
Oh, God. I'm desperate to know what he probably said about sex that you suddenly realised.
Well,
no,
I mean,
true,
I definitely
actually
would have. And also at that age when you were a virgin. Yeah. Gareth, just want to let you know, I know what you mean about sex.
You're bang on, actually, Gareth. You're dead right. And I say that from experience, I swear.
Probably that it was like some weird, mysterious thing, is what I imagine. Oh, I don't know. It's so bad. I wish I could remember more. I mean, looking at it, what I really feel is that it's a bunch of sort of platitudinous things where you're trying to be grown up and you don't understand what you're saying.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Having done a series and a half of this show now and reading out a different poem of mine on every single one, it's all pretty, yeah, pretty empty. I mean, it's all, yeah, just words I've kind of maybe heard with like, yeah, 3 degrees of separation, and then I just make them try and rhyme. But ultimately, utter, yeah, dribble.
Well, all I remember is like the seriousness and the intensity and the kind of, which is quite sweet because it's so hard to keep it, that feeling of I'm really going to capture something like here and now on the page, and it's really important that I do.
Really? Did you have that? You had that feeling at the time?
Yeah, yeah. I remember how seriously I took it at the time of like a feeling, I suppose, of I've got so much to say. And I've got so much sort of feeling that if I don't get this down, then it's lost forever. Like, it's just really important that I write this right now.
Well, of course, because you are the person who in French thought, soon you'll hear me roar. So, of course, you thought, well, I need to put this down now because this is gold. Oh, don't waste this.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, I definitely don't regret the fact I wrote so much poetry and stuff as a kid because it's interesting to look back on, but I certainly didn't at the time think I need to get this down now because in future,
maybe there was
elements of thinking someday when someone's writing a biography on me, they can use this. But I don't think I thought, oh, this is important now. I just would have thought at the time, this is genius, and I am as great as I will ever be, because no one can be greater than this, is what I would have thought.
I didn't write a lot. I said, I think that I got into writing much later, but I think it's because, yeah, I think I was more into art. I was more kind of visual person, and I didn't feel like it's not, we didn't have an inspirational English teacher or anything like that. It was just dry, boring. I just thought it was really boring. But now it's like, you know, well, I mean, it's weird now writing a book. It's, I couldn't imagine not reading, and I couldn't, and I feel like I read more than ever, and it's, but I feel really like I've educated myself quite late in life on actually what I like in terms of reading.
Have you written any adult poetry? I'm not going to ask you to read it.
Well, the honest, I feel like it's too pretentious to tell the truth, but that's just immature. What I love now is, I actually really like prose poetry. And I would say that some of the chapters in my book are more of an attempt at prose poetry. So that's the closest I've got to it, I'd say, as an adult. I don't think I've actually sat down and written a proper poem, though.
Yeah.
But sometimes when I'm writing prose, it's like if I just let... It's like I can just slip into a slightly different way of thinking about it, where I stop thinking, is this funny? And I kind of start listening to it and the rhythm of it, and I get really... But I have to be in that mood. I have to be in that really sincere mood. And it depends what the subject matter is as well.
And have you... written any poetic messages to men to tell them that you agree with their opinions on sex as an adult?
What, as an adult?
Yeah. Well, I suppose text messages. You know what? I was thinking, what you said the other day about sex is bang on. Anyway,
I know what you mean about sex.
Happy 39th birthday.
I say it straight after now. I know what you mean about that sex.
Yeah. I know what you mean, actually.
That we just had.
That was a bit weird, you're right, yeah. Didn't see that coming. Okay, well, it comes to the time now, Katie, where I must score your work on three different categories. Those categories are, as always, originality, pure teen horniness, and the Mickey Mouse Club Ryan Gosling Ryan Goose score, which is how much potential does it show for what I now know you to be? Does it show the future star the same style? So first of all, originality. Well, look, I've got to give you points for the sheer versatility of what you just read to me, because there's a whole load of stuff going on in there. None of those are like the other. I mean, Oh, really? What, for the big finale? Okay.
I've saved the best to last.
Dear
I
Carol Vorderman.
Does that give it away?
Well, you know, you're building your own hype there, but, you know, we've got to keep people listening. We want that engagement rate if we're going to get that ad money. So, dear Carol Vorderman and a message to Gareth are the only things that I think in any way connect. The Bogeyman personification poem is completely different to all the rest, and it's a bit Spike Milligan.
Can I also just say about that poem? It genuinely feels like I've copied it down from somewhere else. I bet if I Googled it now.
Yeah, it's belonged to
and
someone.
And I haven't, but...
Well, okay.
Yeah, maybe it was
I think you've got range, because you've got that. You've got the Bogeyman poem, which sounds like Spike Milligan, but in an original way. You've got John 42 from Crew, which sounds almost like... The subject matter is almost like Larkin, but it's written much more jovially. Dear Carol Vorderman's like a little roast. And then Octopus Heart... is completely different to all of them, and so is the message to Gareth. So I've got to give it basically, I'm going to give 4 out of 5 for originality.
Great.
Because
I appreciate that.
Yeah, there's just so much range. Pure teen horniness, well, I must say it was pretty low until
I know what you mean about sex.
I don't think I'd have got, I really would have struggled to find any
it's
horniness
so
in any
like
of them until
banal. It doesn't give away good or bad feelings.
You randomly it doesn't feel particularly horny, to be honest. It just feels a bit like you're bluffing. You know, I'll go 3, just because it mentions it. I'll go 3 out of 5.
But
pure teen
I'm
horniness.
Too young. It's too young for horniness. Yeah. I think I was about 12.
Well, there we go. 3 out of 5, just because you mention it, and it's like you're keen to just acknowledge to Gareth.
Yeah.
I'm also aware of the word sex. and Mickey yeah. Mouse Club, Ryan Gosling, Ryan Gosling. Now, I can't say any of this reflects massively what I know your work to be today, but anecdotally, a lot of what you said, I mean, matched with what I imagined. I mean, there were skits. Bogeyman, I mean, there's an element of Bogeyman where you're like, well, you know, it checks out comedically.
It's a laugh.
It's an absolute laugh.
It's an absolute giggle a minute, that poem.
Carol Vorderman poem as well. It's just a gag.
It's got a punchline. The Bogeyman's got a punchline.
Exactly. Set up punchline. Carol Vorderman's just a gag. So I will go 3 out of 5 for that. So that is 10 out of 15. That is a very respectable early work score. And now I will read you something of mine to level the playing field, of course. And this...
How old were you when you wrote this?
I don't know 100%, but there's another poem in this book which references waiting until I'm 18. So I would guess 17. If I'm obsessed with turning 18, I must be 17, right?
Yeah, that makes sense. The younger you are, the more of excuse one has if it's shit.
Oh, big time.
Because then you can imagine me at 17, a genius.
Oh, I've got some I've got some poems from when I'm like 24 that I'm eventually going to have to read out because I've got nothing left on this show and I am dreading it. There's some that reference the city I was in when I was at university, which...
Because it's like when you hear like that George Harrison song that he wrote when he was 24.
Yeah.
Within you, without you. Like when you hear that and you think 24... You think, there's no excuse.
Yeah, you need to be, okay, so here we go, 17. Our lives are a one-liner of time. The waiting game, not a favourite to play of mine. I wait for your face on a calendar that doesn't have a start or finish. My dreams repeat, then pick up speed among the minutes we diminish. Quick, I forget. Are we together yet? Are we destined for romance? Are we fated another mischance, empty arms, excuse for happiness? Because alone we can't achieve what I believe to be the secret. I hope I'm not wrong, but with you my smile's not temporary for long. There we go.
It's quite Alan Partridge. It feels like it would be an I Partridge.
Yeah, all right. I mean, I can't argue with that.
Do you know what I mean? Especially... the time bit, I could really hear it.
Yeah, our lives are a one-liner of time. I mean, it's exactly...
Well, it feels like it would be in the Oast House, like his attempt at poetry.
He's got deep in the Oast House and decided to write, our lives are a one-liner of time. I mean, that can't mean anything, surely. A one-liner of time. It's just, they don't even...
No. I mean, I like the using of the one-liner. As a metaphor.
How about, I wait for your face on a calendar that doesn't have a start or finish?
It feels a bit derivative, I guess. I liked, are we going to, what did you say, are we going to be together yet?
Quick, I forget. Are we together yet?
That's very, like, American somehow.
I mean, a calendar without a start or a finish. What's that, just a picture book? I wait for your face. That's just numbers. Yeah, that's just numbers. And waiting for your face on it. Jesus Christ. Yeah, I mean, I was clearly going through a time. Also, interestingly, the pen changes halfway through this poem. So,
oh, wow. Clearly felt that's quite significant.
I had to get it out and was like, fuck, this has run out.
Can you remember who you were writing about?
Yeah, I mean, it's between two. And it didn't work out. And we're getting married next week, so you know, these are my vows.
You mean it's between two people?
At that age, it's between two different people, but there's one that it's almost definitely.
Oh, okay.
Especially with lines like I forget, are we together yet? There is one person who I wrote countless things like this about,
right.
And
so
occasionally
there was, like,
showed
one obsession.
Yeah,
I remember, like, a therapist saying to me once that when we were talking about longing, and she said something really good, like, you know, no art would have been made without, well, things that were made, you know, no art would have been made without longing or something.
I know, but I think you can agree that this wasn't worth it.
Yeah.
I don't think anyone's looking at that going, yeah, I know you went through that pain, but look what came out of it.
Do you ever feel like you're still doing stuff to impress one person in the world?
Yeah, largely, though, it's changed from, like, you know, people I fancied when I was younger has changed to people who've wronged me professionally. It's now revenge. Before it was like what, you don't love me? Well, this will make you love me. And now it's a bit more like, here's how wrong you were not to book me for the thing I wasn't ready for at the time.
I sometimes have a thing even now, like, not so much now, but when I first went on Twitter, there was like some particular people that if they liked it, I'd be like, oh, fine. Thank God for that.
Oh, really? What, it would justify the tweet?
I would sort of think, well, I kind of wrote it for them. So I'm glad they've seen it and I'm glad they liked it, because that's all I'm, you know, that's what I've decided to pin all my self-esteem on, just that one.
Well, this
action
is the opposite. If the person I wrote this poem about heard this poem at the time, I think I would have been distraught.
Yeah.
But I need you to score it now.
Oh, sorry.
On the same category. So the first one is originality. Out of five.
It feels a little, it feels maybe a bit typical of teenage poetry to me. Sorry, no offence.
Hey, look,
I'm going to go three.
I think you're being generous there. I don't think you believe that three is the right number, but I'll take it.
Okay.
Pure teen horniness.
Yeah, quite high. I mean, it was quite, I'd say it was kind of sexually subtle.
Thank you.
But the longing was there. I know what you mean about sexually subtle poetry.
Yeah, of course you do. Gareth told you about it.
I would say, actually, it wasn't that, maybe four.
Okay.
If horniness and like longing are similar,
yeah,
you're
it's quite
count them as the same thing.
It's more sort of like romantically desperate than out and out sexual, I suppose.
Yeah, but it takes quite a lot of confidence to write a poem like that when you're a teenager, I think.
Yeah, I mean, and it certainly wasn't sexual confidence.
No, exactly. Like, who's writing sexually confident?
Sexually confident teenage poetry is possibly the genre I want to see the least. Yeah, that's what I'll release at the end of this.
I know what mine would be. I know what you mean about sex.
Yeah. Mickey Mouse Club score, which is just, you know, how much potential does it show? How close is it to the vibe now?
It's been a while since I've seen your stand-up. Maybe it's changed. I don't know. You tell me. but it shows like linguistic skill and, you know, intelligence and observation of the world around you. I'm going to go sort of four. It's okay. Confident. It's a confident voice.
Okay.
It may not be the same, but I think
there's enough in there, you think?
Yeah.
That
absolutely.
It's not a shock. Okay, cool. So that means my score is 11 out of 15.
What was mine again?
10.
Oh.
So technically I win 11-10. But the message of this podcast, as always, is that there's no winners. We're both losers. And now that just brings us to the final bit, where your much hyped final piece that we will put a soundtrack underneath, which you did build up.
Yeah, I don't know why. Also, one last thing I'd like to say, which I've noticed about a lot of these poems, is that I write the end at the end on all of them, which I think is quite
really?
Sweet.
Okay. I wonder what...
They've all got the end written down the bottom.
Like,
I think it's
fairy
what you
tale.
Meant. It's like... Yeah, it's like for years and years and years, I thought Anon was like Aesop. Like when I saw a poem and it said Anon, I was like, Anon's written so much.
Yeah, of course. I mean, why as a kid would you think that was short for anonymous? You would just think...
Yeah.
Of course,
so
yeah.
So I similarly wrote the end at the end of everything.
Well, hang on. Are you saying that that's the same and you thought that there was an author called The End?
No. No,
and
like,
it was your moniker
know,
that you were going by. Yeah.
The Edge, great poem.
Yeah.
No, I just find it funny.
So what's this one called?
It's called Why Are You Crying?
Great.
Why are you crying? Can you not see that it is too late for hypocrisy? So I've done that. Deny your feelings and hide behind truth. Talk to your body, your proof. The dead are for dying. I love that line. The dead are for dying. A mask makes no scream. Talk to your dreams. Then run away laughing every sight, every sound. You are the fox, they are the hound. The end.
Oh, and that's such a good poem by The End. I love The End. My favourite author, The End, wrote that amazing poem about the fox and the hound, my favourite pub.
You are the fox, they are the hound is my favourite bit.
Some absolutely mad lines in there. Your body, your proof. Is this some...
I mean, that feels pretty relevant.
This is lyrics, right? This has to be lyrics.
It feels very... Hashtag me too. I'm disappointed how little sense it makes. But, you know, that's the classic thing, isn't it? If someone who doesn't know how to write, is that you write things without clarity. And even some of my favourite poetry now, at first glance, may seem obscure, but I think becomes really clear when you pay close attention. But this...
Well, maybe in a few... Maybe in you know, 100 years, someone will find this and go, oh, my God, the dead are for dying. I know exactly what she means. I know what you mean about the
I
dead,
know
actually.
It means, like, for dying, or, like, they're, you know, are they for it, as in they...
Approve
they
of it.
They support it.
Yeah.
Or are they... That's, like, their purpose. Oh, well, no, the dead. No, yeah, they're for dying.
They're for,
or, like,
dying. They approve of dying.
A mask makes no scream is actually quite decent, because it's true. It makes no sound.
Yeah, and it couldn't be more relevant for our current times.
What I'm seeing here is totally uncomfortable with the very surreal, which is, you know, which is true of today. And I think you're frightened of it. And I'm less frightened of the surreal imagery.
It's very much, it's like really pushing metaphor, squeezing metaphors into one thing.
I swear to God, if you copied and pasted that and put it on Twitter and said, oh, I've just found this Anne Sexton poem, everyone would believe you.
There we go, Katie Wick's there, and she knows what you mean about sex, by the way. Whirlwind of an episode. I mean, I was pretty furious for a week at how she reacted to my RE guess. I guessed that she was amazing at a subject that no one cared about, and then arbitrarily chose RE, and it turns out she got the best RE grade in the county. I mean, it's the first time I've actually freaked myself out with one of those guesses. The rest of them, they're easy. I just look at them and I just go, you're probably like that. And then sometimes I say things that are vague enough, like a horoscope, and they're pretty bang on. That one was so specific and she didn't even care. What's the point? I mean, honestly, if comedy never recovers, I'm going into full-time psychology. Is there a market for that, do you think, for that kind of therapy where patients come in and just you just go, up, don't tell me, let me guess. And then you get it right and then you don't solve any problems that came from it. There probably is a market for that. As ever, please do rate the podcast, leave us a review, and tell your birth mother when you finally track her down about this, the best podcast. Goodbye.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.